This is Mary Lewis at A Tiny Homestead, the podcast comprised entirely of conversations with homesteaders, cottage food producers, and crafters. Today I'm talking with Leah at Clear Creek Ranch Mom. Good afternoon, Leah. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
Good. Tell me about yourself and the Clear Creek Ranch Mom.
You betcha. So I am a lifelong Nebraska girl, born and raised in Northeast Custer County, which is right in the middle of the state of Nebraska. We call ourselves the gateway to the Nebraska Sand Hills, just on the east side of the Nebraska Sand Hills. And I'm fifth generation rancher on my family's operation here in Custer County that was homesteaded in 1878. And grew up in went to a one-room schoolhouse, if you know what those are. Had a fantastic K-8 education with my siblings and other neighborhood kids. Went to the University of Nebraska-Lincoln for my undergraduate, where I met my husband, Mr. Clear Creek, as I affectionately call him. And after we lived and worked professionally using those degrees we'd earned, after about 10 years and when our oldest daughter was 4, we decided it was time to return to the family operation. So we moved home in 2012 in the height of terrible flash drought, making it very memorable, and rejoined the family operation, working off the place to supplement income and working on the place at the same time, and have been here ever since. I work as much as I can on the place, more seasonally at times than others, as I also hold down a full-time job as the executive director of the Nebraska Grazing Lands Coalition, which is a nonprofit organization that focuses on using grants to provide education for ranchers who are looking to steward their ground well through things like grazing education, ranching for profitability, and how to get more knowledge on things like managing the invasive red cedars, those kinds of things.
Wow. So your professional life is basically an echo of your home life.
Yes, absolutely. Nice. Yes. I'm very blessed. I have been raised in a family that values conservation and taking care of the soil, taking care of the livestock. So it's a way to get to do those things that I care about day in and day out. And this is our heritage that we leave, and we want to leave it better than we found it.
That's fantastic. I love it. So I know nothing about ranching because I didn't grow up where there were ranches. I grew up in New England, and there aren't really ranches in New England. There may be, but they're probably small scale. So when I hear ranch, I think deserty area with cattle and lots of dust and guys in cowboy boots and bandanas and big old belt buckles. That's my picture in my head. And I'm sure that's not accurate at all. So how many head of cattle do you guys have on average a year?
Well, that can change from year to year, but I would say something unique about the word ranch, which hasn't been around for all that long. Our actual operations name is Clear Creek Farm, because my grandfather, who officially named it when he formed a corporation, named it a farm because that's what they do. That's what they call them in the Southeast United States. And we raised thoroughbred horses. And I think he maybe hoped maybe someday one of our horses would end up running the Kentucky Derby. And all of those farms down there where they raise those beautiful horses are called farms. Now the running joke is if it's east of the Mississippi River, it's called a farm. If it's west of the Mississippi River, it's called a ranch. But the terms are really interchangeable as far as I'm concerned. If you have animals living on your place, I would call it a ranch. If you have row crops on your place, it may be called a farm. So though some people take the terminology very seriously, I try not to do that.
And again, this is why I love doing this podcast, because I learn something new every time I talk to somebody.
Absolutely. And the truth is, for the family farm and ranch operations in the United States, having some diversity is key to staying in the black. and having a chance at earning some profit at the end of the year after your bills are paid. That's why we're diversified, and pretty much everybody who lives around us is what you call a diversified operation. And also, the other types of ruminant livestock that people run to make money, like sheep or goats, are all an important component of our economy as well, and feeding Americans and feeding the globe. So it's not just one single depiction, though John Wayne did a pretty good job of helping with Hollywood give an illustration of what a ranch looks like. We raise red cattle. We raise red Angus and Hereford cattle crosses in a commercial herd. We raise polled Hereford registered stock, and we raise what are called native shorthorns in an additional herd. Cow-calf operation is what we primarily do. However, after the weaning of these calves in the fall, we feed them out, what's called backgrounding them, until they're ready to sell or go to the feedlot to be finished. We're not a finishing operation. That requires the right setup, the right equipment, and it's a heavily labor-intensive process to finish cattle. And we just don't have that time when we're diversified doing other things as we are. But it really is that diversity that allows us to focus on the efficiencies of staying in business. That requires us to be diversified doing lots of different things.
Yeah. So what you're saying is all your eggs are not in one basket.
That is correct. And to put it in the plainest of terms, it is that diversity that helped my family, my ancestors, weather many storms in the last century, from the hardships of the Depression and what was known as the Dirty 30s, when it was so dry in this part of the country, through other economic hardships and drought. And, you know, it used to be that if cattle markets were high, crop markets were low, and vice versa. It's not that way anymore, which makes it more difficult. But again, the essential component of being diversified, so you have different commodities and things to lean on as a source of revenue for your place. Very, very important.
Yeah, for sure. A lot of the conversations I've had in the last 6 months have been with people who have just started their thing in the last few years since COVID, but that is not your situation. And so I'm curious as to what made you go back to the family farm? Because you said that you weren't at the farm and then you went back.
Yep. If you had asked me mid through my university journey if I'd end up back here, the answer would have been no. I hope someone goes back amongst my siblings, but I don't think it'll be me. I had starry-eyed adventures in mind. I took an internship in Washington, D.C., which was to support ag policy and the work of a nonprofit. I loved it. I love the feeling of experiencing new and different things. I focused my degree area in planning to work in higher education and advise college students, not particularly in agriculture, but in any degree-seeking program. I really didn't have it in mind. But when my oldest child was born and we would come home on weekends and visit the grandparents and help with the cattle work and make ourselves available because sometimes there just aren't enough hands on hand, I felt that calling. While my childhood wasn't perfect, and particularly remembering the hardships of the farm crisis in the mid-1980s when things got real, real tight here and everywhere in the Midwest, all I could think about was the values that I learned, the examples set for me, the examples set by my parents as parents and then as grandparents, the community-focused people here who still believe in leaning on one another, helping each other, serving their community through volunteer efforts, the safety conversation about safe places to raise kids. It all came together. And my husband and I talked about it. He grew up on a farm as well, though that farm had been sold by then, and so it wasn't an option for us. We just knew that it was the right thing to do for our family. you might say there was a bit of that pull of feeling of some obligation, perhaps. I'm the oldest, and I saw my dad starting to age, you know, a little bit. So there were some other components as well, but I just had this calling, this feel, this pull that I should be back here, even if it didn't mean being involved with the operation directly or full time, that it was the right place to be. That being said, I know how privileged I am that I had that opportunity waiting for me, and how much I appreciate the people who are your audience, who have made the investment, the plunge, taken a leap of faith, whatever you want to call it, to chart into these waters for the first time, or maybe skipped a generation or reimagined it as something else. It is so courageous, and the future of agriculture depends on people like those folks who are willing to say, I'm going to put my feet in the water and I'm going to try to do this thing, figuring it out along the way. You're the biggest heroes there are, because it is not easy, and way harder for the people who don't necessarily have someone to lean upon, or maybe the knowledge to start with. It's really a challenge.
Yeah, I'm one of those people who is really, really nervous around big animals like cattle and horses. I know the odds of getting hurt by a cow, a steer, or a horse are pretty low, especially if I'm not around them. But friends have horses, and I love one of them. Her name is Ginger. She's really friendly. She's almost too friendly. Mm-hmm. We were over visiting one time, and I was out in the horse pasture with my friend, and the two horses were way over in the corner, and my friend and I were talking, and our backs were to where the horses were, mm-hmm. and got involved in a conversation, and Ginger was all of a sudden behind me and nudging my elbow with her face. And I didn't know she was there. I literally did not hear her walk up because we were so animated in what we were talking about. And it really startled me, because an animal that big, you would think I would have heard her walk up, and mm-hmm. no, nope. And I'm 5'9" and probably 165, 170 pounds. And I consider myself to be a substantial person. Mm-hmm. And that horse is far more substantial than I am. Had she come up any faster, I would have been on the ground. So the reason I share this story is because I think that it takes somebody really brave, whether you're male or female or non-binary, I don't really care, to work with big animals. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you feel about working with big animals, but I'm a little scared of it.
Well, first I would say Ginger, that's the best kind of mare to have. She's what you call in your pocket. Mm-hmm. And, that means she has a great deal of trust of humans. Also, and maybe your horse friends have already educated on this, horses almost unequivocally will never run over a human being. They will dart around you. They will endanger themselves. Way beyond any measure before they would ever consider running into humans. They just don't. So mm-hmm. usually you get yourself hurt because you dart too and they end up hitting you. But yeah. And there are exceptions to that. But that's nice that she has such a nice mare that you could get acquainted with to overcome some of that. And you're always the most comfortable with your own livestock. Of course, I grew up around them. So it's just second nature for me. And it was very important to my husband and I to introduce the children to them young in a safe environment where they learn to be respectful, responsible, and learn how to work as one with them instead of against them. That being said, when the hormones are flowing in the early spring, especially the large herd bulls that we use for breeding, all bets are off, because as I say, with any kind of animal out there, they're still an animal. They're unpredictable and you cannot fully trust what they are going or not going to do. So I wouldn't want to wear a blood pressure monitor on the days where I'm helping manage and move those big herd bulls to their summer pastures, because it is a day where the adrenaline is flowing in the animals and the people. But you mm-hmm. have to be confident and conscious of what's going on around you, and do what you need to do. And cattle are a little slower on the thinking side. You can generally think of what they're going to do right before they do it. So, That's you keep yourself out of harm's way most of the time.
Okay. Boy, I'm not sure what to ask you. I don't know enough about ranching to know what to ask, and I didn't do any research. So I was like, it'll be fine. It's never fine when I think, it'll be fine.
How about I tell you a little bit about Clear Creek Ranch, Mom?
That would be great.
Okay. So I don't know when you found my page, but I launched Clear Creek Ranch Mom back in 2019 on a whim. We had and I can't remember where you're from, Mary.
Minnesota. Well, I'm from New England to begin with, but I've lived in Minnesota for over 25, maybe 30 years now.
Okay. So you may remember this from the news. In March of 2019, we were stricken with a storm called a bomb cyclone.
Yes. Yep.
We had a very cold, snowy February. The frost was thick. In fact, a few days before the bomb cyclone, this is just my kind of humor, but I'm good friends with the man who digs graves here. He's the only person who digs graves in this rural part of the state. He's a friend, and I saw him at Pizza Hut, and he was commenting that the frost was so thick at that time that they had to order a special tool in order to do the excavation work to dig graves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just one of those things I never thought about how hard it was making his job. I knew how hard it was to be a rancher, but I didn't think about it. So the frost was exceptionally thick, and the bomb cyclone started as very cold rain, which caused rapid snowfall melt and then flooding because the soil was impermeable from that thick frost. So it began as this heavy rain. We started to have flooding. The waters came up. Everyone was starting to get baby calves in this part of the country. So record amounts of flooding. I mean, historical levels of flood waters moving, bridges being busted out because all of the frozen ice on the lakes and the creeks and rivers all started to move and move downstream and just annihilated dams and annihilated bridges, and here Clear Creek, where my name comes from, rose to epic levels I'd never seen and blew out bridges. Meanwhile, these floodwaters were rushing everywhere because the water couldn't go into the soil, and we knew we were in trouble. And thankfully, we really hadn't started calving much yet, but because once you start having baby calves are taught inherently by their mothers to be quiet and be still. After being born, they don't move, and that is because of that biological understanding of being protected from predators. But the people who had baby calves were in real trouble because the floodwaters literally swept those calves away. They just they didn't know to get up and get out of the way. So that happened on day one, and on day two, a roaring blizzard came in behind and refroze things and caused more devastation. And I saw on social media, suddenly, dozens of requests. Help me find my cattle. Where can I find emergency relief supplies of fence? My fence all got washed away because the floodwaters receded quickly, but they had already done their damage. I need help. I need help getting feed. All my feed got washed away. And so I started my page as a way to just try to start gathering resources and putting them in one place where people could find them. You know, starting here with my own community and then my state, trying to help send resources where I had people saying, hey, I've got hay, where can I go with it? Or I want to help. I want to help people find their cattle, those kinds of things. That's really how Clear Creek Ranch Mom was born. And then on the back side of it, started to share stories of resilience and hope and recovery and ideas from people, particularly women, who felt helpless in the aftermath, which many of us did because there was nothing that could be done about some of the devastation. To lead one another. And if you know enough about ag communities right now, a pretty proud and private group of people who don't like to air their dirty laundry and share their struggles and hardships, and wanted to create a safe place where people could come to lean on one another, share those real stories, and for the rest of the people who don't know or don't understand, be a place to find trusted resources, trusted information and education to say, oh, that's why this happened, or this is why this is this way. And especially reaching consumers when they would like to know, well, you know, why has beef gone up in price? Or what is this grass-fed versus conventional-fed beef? Which one should I buy? Or the attacks that happen on the dairy industry in particular. Just be a trusted place where people could come to get information, to laugh, to cry together at times, but really create community. And I know that I touch nerves sometimes, but I've tried very hard to stay non-political in nature and just focus on that community and bringing people together to be able to ask those questions and get that information and let people make decisions for themselves on best practices. And that's why I made the jokes about farm versus ranch, because some people really get their hackles up and they're very proud of how they define their operation or the history of their place. And that's good. And I have plenty of that here too. I sometimes dig my heels in too much, but lack of understanding, especially from the world outside of agriculture, is made worse by the infighting in the industry. We don't need that. We all need to lean on and work with one another, because we're in danger of always of being attacked in the very least, or in some cases working to eliminate us because of lack of understanding, lack of knowledge, lack of compassion and care. We really need to focus on working together better than we are.
Yeah. That's a phenomenal reason to start a Facebook page or group, by the way, helping out. That's amazing. Regarding the two terms, ranch or farm, I don't really have a lot of stories for people today, but this is one of the stories I can tell about the terminology, because when we moved to our 3.1 acre lot of land, I didn't know what to call it, because we already had our name. We had a tiny homestead, but that was from our old house in town on a tenth of an acre lot, because I thought it was cute. Ha ha, it's a tiny homestead. It's a little tiny lot in town. And 3.1 acres is not huge, but it's much bigger than a tenth of an acre. So I was like, okay, we'll keep a tiny homestead as the name. But my husband kept referring to our new place as the farm. Mm-hmm. And I was like, we're not a farm. We don't grow corn or soybeans. We don't have big old combines and stuff. And he says, honey, he said, we're going to be growing a humongous garden that we sell produce from. He said, that's a farm. And I said, but it doesn't feel like a farm. And he said, well, he said, do we have chickens? And I said, yes. He said, well, will we be selling tomatoes and cucumbers and squash? And I said, yes. He said, it's a farm. I said, okay, fine. Tiny homestead farm. And he said, no. He said, the name of the business is a tiny homestead, but when I say the farm, it's where we live. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, thank you for clarifying all that. I appreciate it. So there was even some confusion about terminology between my husband and I about what our place is. So I can see why there might be confusion about ranch versus farm on bigger scale.
Sure. Well, I admire you very much, and I love it. I appreciate it, because then this is what I say at my job, at my paying job. And this is what I say in my community. This is what I say online. The future of agriculture depends on people like you, Mary, and your husband. I think for a long time we have managed to segregate us, in a sense, that might be a strong word, in this country, and leave food production to the small number of people on the quote ranches and farms. But homesteading is what established this country and knit this country together. A bunch of homesteaders who all produced first for their own family and then began to produce for others. And land is a commodity that's in large tracts, is not available to most. But the homesteading philosophy, the farming philosophy, is something that almost everyone is capable of. And oh, I get pushback sometimes. I'm not a farmer. I don't have time. I don't know how to grow anything. I can't do anything. I can't make a difference. And I say, if you can get a coffee can and some soil and a south-facing window, you can be part of building the food security of your family in this country. I very firmly believe this education needs to be in our preschools and K-12 system. Show every American that they can be part of that food security that sometimes it scares me. It scared a lot of people during COVID. I had people calling me, cousins calling me from their rural or urban homes, hundreds of miles away, saying, "What am I going to do if I can't get in a grocery store? Do you have beef that I can have? Can you grow stuff in your garden for me?" And I spent so much time helping connect relatives and friends with, you know, different resources online with, "Hey, look, here's a farmer in your area who's raising beef. Here's how to get a container garden growing. You can feed your family some tomatoes and some lettuce. You can be part of providing that security to your family. And thanks to the internet, you can pick up just about any skill that you need in order to do this." And so that small farm, small ranch, homesteading philosophy, I hope it continues to catch fire, because I see it as necessary in so many ways. And again, you can show how long ago it was, not that long ago, that everybody played a role in the security of their family's needs, and how far away from that we've moved. And it's just terrifying to me. And those are life skills. So I find it very important to get that curriculum in front of kids, who can become generational operators. Maybe their folks aren't or don't know anything or not invested, but it's my new goal for Clear Creek Ranch Mom. Yes, the captive audience here is people already in agriculture, but I need to be the minority in the room. I need to be taking my message out to the masses who say, "I don't know how to do any of this, but I want to be part of this. And I certainly want to help advocate for the industry, because we need those voices."
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not sure how to ask this question, because I don't know the industry terms, but you know how there are chicken farms, like we have a chicken farm down the road, mm-hmm. and it's a business. It's not a farm. It's a building, mm-hmm. and they have chickens inside that building.
Yep.
I know that those chickens are probably not very happy. Our 18 chickens right now that we own are free ranging mm-hmm. in our 3.1 acre property. They're out digging in the little bit of snow we got yesterday and the fallen leaves from last fall. And they've been doing this for weeks. We've been letting them out of the run. They are very happy chickens. They are fat. They are sassy. They come say hi. They eat everything. It's great. The chickens down the road, probably not as happy. You are not a factory beef producing place. You are a farm.
Yes. And I'll be honest with you. I don't like the term factory, because it always connotes something negative. What they're called is a confined feeding operation.
Okay. So help me, because that's why I said, I don't know how to ask this question, but sure. I think you know what I'm getting at.
Yep. I sure do.
Okay.
You know, animal care and animal husbandry has been and always will be one of the most important components of being good at living and working in this industry. And in order to feed the masses of Americans in the system that we have now, we are required to maximize efficiency, which means how can we take that animal to harvest weight, harvest age, harvest condition in the fastest, most efficient way possible. Mm-hmm. That requires us to have have what we call confined feeding operations. Okay. That goes for beef cattle, that goes for sheep, that goes for goats, and that goes for chickens.
Okay.
So there are very, very strict regulations put out by the USDA that are supposed to govern how all of these operations work. That has been refined over the ages. As we know better, we do better most of the time. And we can talk all day long about what animals do or don't need to be content, satisfied, efficient, whatnot.
Uh-huh.
Ultimately, the proof is in if the animal is not getting superb care, they're not going to gain efficiently and they're not going to harvest the way you want them to be. That being said, again, we go back to the homesteader philosophy that settled this country. Those things didn't exist. They all lived like your chickens do.
Mm-hmm.
and you were providing for your family and maybe the neighbors, maybe your folks or in-laws lived on your homestead too, but it was on a smaller scale. I am all about finding ways for people to help raise their own food if possible and do it in a more natural way. But the confined feeding operations will have their place because we have, unfortunately, less and less people involved in food production annually. Mm-hmm. So I personally feed out quite a few beef to finish that are then harvested and sold to friends, neighbors, customers, a customer base I've built, all within a fairly local level, you know, less than 100 miles. And yeah, where I live, 100 miles is considered local.
No, that's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But on a bigger scale, that's where we have the confined feeding operations. That being said, most of the confined feeding operations who get a bad rap because there's a few bad apples out there, there's some bad images, you know, that got onto social media, some bad operators have managed to convince people that these animals are not living well or that their care is not being of utmost priority, when the truth is I would eat off the floor in a good number of these operations because of their strict standards and guidelines that they operate with. So I don't have concerns overall. When I think about the poultry barns you're talking about, they're much like, we have one in Nebraska now. It's much the same for feeding out hogs for pork production. But I've been in those facilities before. And while I think that I'm trying to put myself into the shoes of the hog or the chicken, and maybe I think or don't think what they want, I, at the end of the day, our own misconceptions tend to dictate more than what is reasonable or thought. And an example I would give is cattle being outside when it's cold. There are probably millions of Americans who are uninformed, and they would say, if it's below zero, your animals don't belong outdoors.
Uh-huh.
I could not push my guardian dogs indoors at 0 degrees. Mm-hmm. Now, when it got to minus 40 in January,
yeah,
the lead dog reluctantly came in for the night only and was roaring at the door to get out at sunup the next day.
Uh-huh.
The same goes for the beef cattle. As long as they have protection from the wind, adequate feed, and open water, they are fine. But it's us humans tending to think that we know better, we know best over what Mother Nature designed some of these animals to live in what conditions. Now, my Nebraska cows would hate it in Florida. They wouldn't be able to breathe in the summer humidity because they're not acclimated.
Right.
And those cows can wade with alligators. Still don't know, understand that one, but they would not want to get dropped here when it's minus 40. We had zero death loss through that terrible cold streak in January because we know what we're doing in providing the best care for that livestock. And it did not mean that they came inside.
No. And the thing is livestock. Pets are pets. And that's something I've had to learn since I moved here 3.5 years ago. Sure. We have barn cats and we love them. They are friendly and they come say hi, but they're not pets.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want a house cat ever again. We had house cats. They were lovely. Mm-hmm. And I was a cat person. And then I didn't have a good place for a litter box in the new house, and our last remaining house cat passed away, and I was like, I don't want cats anymore in the house because all I have to do to pet a kitty cat is to go outside to the barn because they're out there. And now we have one pet. Her name is Maggie. She's a mini Australian Shepherd. I love her to pieces. She is our pet. Mm-hmm. She is our fifth baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I would do anything for this dog, which is ridiculous. However, the chickens, I don't care. The barn cats, they're nice. I love them, but they're not my babies. So again, livestock is livestock. Pets are pets. And it's a very different mindset.
Yeah. Yes. And one of the messages that you are invaluable in getting out and I spend time in getting out is farmers and ranchers operate on such tight margins, they can't afford to make foolish decisions regarding the well-being of their soil, the well-being of their crops, the well-being of their livestock. Mm-hmm. So you should not assume that they're planning to just let animals die because they literally can't afford to do that.
No.
They are always focused on making the right decisions. And something that I get emotional about at times is the fact that, and you know this, very easily we human beings in farming and ranching end up putting the livestock and the land ahead of our own people, the needs of our children at times, our spouses,
mm-hmm.
unintentionally. But that is one of the challenges and the breakdowns that happens, especially in a family operation where you're trying to run a business and be a family. The animals get put ahead of everyone's needs, sometimes too much, and that can cause its own ripple effects. But for consumers to make assumptions that we are drowning them in use of antibiotics and drowning our crops in pesticides and wastefully letting animals perish, it's just not the way it happens.
No, because what would be the point?
Right.
Why would you do that? That's only detrimental to yourself and your bottom line. That's yep. not the thing you're doing. Yeah. I actually have feelers out to the local 4-H organization and the FFA because I would like to do a couple interviews with them because they're the ones who are educating kids who are interested in ag and in the sciences behind agriculture too. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hoping in the next month or two to have a couple podcasts out from those people who can also talk about some of this, because you're right. There are a lot of misconceptions. I mean, I am just as guilty of it as everyone else. I only know what I've been told or what I've read, and I don't believe everything I read. I wasn't born yesterday, but you can only know what you know. You mm-hmm. can only know what you ask to learn about. So I guess my whole point about, I don't know, let's say free range chicken versus cage chickens. I don't know. I'm sure that there are bad operations out there who are sticking 20 chickens in a 4-foot by 3-foot cage and they lay eggs until they die. I'm sure that happens. But I'm also sure that there are places that have clean places for chickens to be raised and they're fed well and they're taken care of. And that's how we get nutritional food.
Mm-hmm.
So I mostly just want to get your take because you are doing the thing. You are doing the cattle raising. And then I have other questions about the cattle because I love baby animals, and I'm assuming that you guys breed mm-hmm. cattle.
Yep.
Do you?
Yep, we sure
okay.
do.
Okay.
Yep.
And is it like a staggered thing where you have babies being born, I don't know, now and then 6 months from now, or is there a certain time of year that there are babies?
So to meet the needs of consumers in this country, you find spring calving herds and fall calving herds. That way you have animals reaching mature harvest dates year round. So you can provide beef year okay. round. We calve in the spring. So that means we turn our herd bulls. We synchronize our heifers. And that's a whole nother conversation so that they are more
yep.
likely to calve in their first calving cycle. But the herd bulls all get turned out the same day. And we typically will start receiving calves about March 15th. So we're
okay.
almost there. Cows are well known for safely birthing their calves up to a couple weeks early. So it literally could be any day now. And we always say Mother Nature drives that if you get a weather front that comes through or a blizzard. They like to have their calves in a blizzard sometimes.
God love them. Yep.
We go for a 75-day calving window. What that means is if a cow misses her first heat cycle, she'll cycle back around while the bull is still out with her and have up to three cycles to get bred. the unfortunate thing for a cow is if she becomes a late cycling, late breed cow as a young cow, historically it just stays that way with her, which can make her have other issues, weaning off lighter calves and whatnot. So we try to get them so that they are synchronized, they cycle and have that breeding window work. First round in the summer breeding season, we put our cows in groups of about 20 to 25, depending on the age of the bull. That's how many cows he can service on his own with no problems. And so that's kind of how we run our operation. And that way we are done getting calves about the time that our Nebraska grazing season really kicks off, depending on weather, there to the middle or end of May. Those calves are born on the ground big enough to get going and get moved out to their summer pastures. And then we wean them off in the fall, as I said, and feed them until February of the following year.
Okay. So when you say wean, do you mean wean from mom?
Yep.
So do they nurse from her that entire time, or is it yep. more she's just protecting them from whatever?
Yep. So they nurse. The nursing in the beginning is essential. They get colostrum, just like human babies do, that helps seal up that gut and really gives their immune system a boost. Mm-hmm. You can purchase a colostrum product. Let's say a cow has twins and maybe you're worried she doesn't have enough colostrum for both calves. You can supplement that way. And they rely on their mother's milk entirely. Through the summer, she will teach that calf how to graze, and research points to that first, really the first 2 years of life is essential for females to learn how to graze properly. Mm-hmm. So they learn that from their mama. Now the nutritional value of what they get from grazing that first summer is not a lot. It's more practice than anything. They really do rely pretty much exclusively on that mother's milk. And then as they grow to that 400 or 500, 600 pound weaning weight in the fall, then we wean them off of the cows and learn, and they learn how to start eating from a bunk. In our case, different operations are set up differently in how they get them onto feeding rations versus additional fall and winter grazing with supplementation. But that's what we do at our place.
Huh. That's really interesting. I did not know that the calves would nurse that long from the moms. I had no idea. Okay, thank you. Just cleared up another thing I was probably completely ridiculously mistaken about. I keep having this happen. I talk to people who know way more than I do. I'm like, oh, I didn't know that.
Something new.
Okay. Good. So do you guys do any artificial insemination stuff, or is it just your bulls?
Yep, we just use our bulls and do pasture breeding. Okay. Artificial insemination is a really nice tool if you know what you're doing, and some people are for hire to do it if you don't want to do it on your own. Again, to help be more selective of the sire that you would like if you're breeding for certain traits. Some people don't like to have a lot of bulls around. As I mentioned earlier, they can be a lot, mm-hmm. requiring additional housing space. Their health care, they're kind of big babies. That's just the way to put it. They are prone to injuries because they fight. They're prone yeah. to having breeding problems, different things like that. So some people choose to purchase semen and artificially inseminate, and then use that tool again to sort of tighten up that calving window so that they can predict the birthing dates of those calves hitting the ground, that kind of thing.
Okay. So do you sell any of the calves to kids who are doing 4-H by any chance, or is that not something you do?
Sure. If anything happens, we will sometimes sell the twins or a bucket calf, what we call that. Maybe something happened to the mama and she has no milk. So we become mama and we're bucket feeding that calf 2 or 3 times a day. We'll often sell those to kids for projects. And, what's depicted on TV or social media is, oh, what a romantic and wonderful idea to have these bucket calves. They're so cute. And your kids, and giving them responsibility and chores. And it is all of those things. However, those chores are very cumbersome, especially if you've got a situation where you have a lot of bucket calves in addition to the rest of your work you've got going on, because they need to be fed, like I said, 2-3 times a day. So we'll cut them loose sometimes.
I was going to say, they're babies. Of course they need a lot.
Yeah, they get in line with everything else going on that time of year.
Yeah, absolutely. I could talk to you all day because you are so knowledgeable and so easygoing about this, because I feel like I am being a total dumbass about asking these questions.
I love nothing more than to invite you to come visit me in person at our ranch in Custer County. I would be delighted to host you.
Yeah, that would be really fun. My son actually just moved to, I think, kind of due north of you toward the top part of the state.
Oh, really?
He just moved. I'm not going to say the town because he probably wouldn't appreciate it, but he and his wife and their daughter just moved back in December, and he moved from Arizona. And okay. So he grew up in Minnesota, went in the service. He was a U.S. Marine for 8 years, and I guess once a Marine, always a Marine, but he's no longer active duty. And he settled in Arizona, and then they decided to move to Nebraska. And he's so happy. He's so in love with Nebraska. It's painful to listen to him talk about it. So I hear great things.
A long line of military veterans in my family, and all of who proudly served the country. So thank him for his service. And I'm so delighted to hear that they have settled in Nebraska, because we need good young men like him and his wife and family here. We need them with the population decline that we're facing. We really need people like him. So tell him thank you for me.
I will. He's so happy. He came and visited a couple weekends ago, and he didn't stop talking from the minute he got his cup of coffee in the morning. Mm-hmm. He did not stop talking until I gave up and went to bed. I was like, honey, I'm tired. I'm going to bed. He's like, okay. And then he stayed up and talked to his dad for another 3 hours. I was like, oh my God, you're so happy. It hurts. I'm so glad you're so happy, but oh my God, calm down.
He works in agriculture, but sounds like he should be podcasting too.
He actually is in computers.
Okay.
He works, he unravels all the messes with the actual server stuff. That's kind of his job, and I'm butchering what he does. He is a computer dude, and he loves it. But the reason he's so excited is because he now has the opportunity to garden. He tried to do gardening in Arizona for 4 years. Could not even get a hot pepper to stay alive.
Yes.
So he's so excited. The reason he came up to visit is because we had an entire shoebox full of seeds. That we weren't going to use. So he was like, I'll take them. So he's very excited to get his gardens going.
Fantastic. That warms my heart. I'm so glad to have him in Nebraska. I hope Nebraska nice is what he experiences all the time, because it's not easy to land in a small town. And if he's north of me, it's likely a small town, and that's not always easy. But I hope that they get plugged in and make friends and really like it.
Well, luckily his wife's family is from there. So, So basically he's been adopted into the town.
Fantastic. That's great.
So right now he's that guy, because people don't really know him that well. Mm-hmm. And people keep referring to him as that guy.
Okay.
And he's 32 years old. That guy has a totally different connotation for him than it does for some of the older people in town.
Sure.
And he's like, I don't want to be that guy. And I was like, honey, they're not saying it the way you understand it.
Right.
He's like, I know. I said, give it till fall. I said,
yep.
Everybody will be out doing their thing, and you'll meet everybody, and then you'll not be that guy anymore. You'll be who you are.
Yep.
He's like, I know, but it's just bad. And I'm like, no, it's fine. I said, at least you're getting noticed for good reasons. That's good. So yeah, he's been having minor streak of sort of growing pains, but also so much happy. I can't tell you how excited I am for them.
I have to cut you off pretty soon, too, to get onto a long Zoom call.
Oh, my. Okay. All right. Well, Leah, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me because I know you are just busy.
Thank you. It has been my pleasure, and it's enjoyable to talk about these things that I care about and meet someone else who's promoting our industry and living it in your own unique way. These are the stories that do comprise America, and we have to tell the story to the masses. So thanks for what you're doing. I've thought about podcasting, and I think, what am I going to talk about? But thank you for being the person that's doing it.
You're welcome. And I'm trying all I can to do this right. All right, Leah, you have a great day.
You do as well. Thank you, Mary. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.